This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Those Southerners of yore who vowed the South will rise again would be pleased to know it has. We've become the most populous area of the country, 121 million strong, but much of that growth has occurred because of in-migration, and that has brought changes. But what's interesting is that many of those people who came here from somewhere else now consider themselves to be Southern. So that raises the question, what does it mean to be Southern in the 21st century? Our two guests this hour were curious about that, too, and because they are political scientists, they immersed themselves in research to find some answers. The result is the book, The Resilience of Southern Identity, Why the South Still Matters in the Minds of Its People. It's the work of Dr. Christopher Cooper, professor of political science at Western Carolina University, and Dr. Gibbs Knotts, chair of the Department of Political Science at the College of Charleston. And both of them are in our studio here at Spirit Square this morning. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Thanks for being here. Do the two of you think of yourselves as being Southerners? Dr. Cooper.
Yeah, I mean, I'll let Gibbs speak for himself, although I'll go ahead and tell you his answer is going to be yes. But no, I think we both do. We both lived in southern states our whole life. But I think one of the reasons we wrote this book, one of the many, is that we sort of struggled with that throughout. I certainly struggled with that throughout my life, right? I do consider myself a Southerner. My family's from the South. I certainly have the Southern lineage that a lot of folks in the region have, but it's something that I've struggled with. Obviously, it's been a region and an identity that's been used for hate, for exclusion over time, but yet it was one that I still clung to parts of. And so I think both of us really wanted to understand that dynamic.
But now you grew up, or you at least spent some time in Northern Virginia.
I did, right. So I was born in South Carolina and lived in there for a little while, and then my family moved to Northern Virginia, and my extended family stayed in South Carolina. Northern Virginia is an interesting place because it certainly seems less and less Southern. So although it is geographically Southern, I do not think it is you don't see as much Southern identity there, certainly.
Dr. Knotts, same question. Obviously, he's already answered.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And yeah, absolutely. I certainly consider myself to be a Southerner, but I've really struggled with it as well. I grew up in metropolitan Atlanta, and, you know, a lot growing up in high school, being Southern a lot of times meant driving a jacked-up pickup truck, wearing a big belt buckle. You know, that's certainly something that I didn't connect with. I went to a college at the University of North Carolina, and there's a lot of people in Chapel Hill who study the region, whether it's from a sociological perspective, a historical perspective, a political science perspective, and I really enjoyed that. I really sort of wanted to roll up my sleeves and better understand this place that has so many contradictions.
Yeah. Are other areas of the country studied like this one is? Are there professors of political science doing the same work that you've done here on the South in other parts of the country?
There's no question the South is the most studied American region. I mean,
why?
It goes back to the Civil War. I mean, this is a region that broke away or tried to break away from the rest of the United States, had a very bad defeat, and a lot of the sort of Southern otherness comes from still feelings about the Civil War. It's an area of the country where segregation was the law of the land, and the fighting against the federal government was sport. And so it's definitely a region that is the most studied. But I do think other regions, we hope this book will, it's not just for Southerners, we hope this book will appeal to people who think about other regions and how their regional identity is part of who they are.
You said going after the federal government was kind of sport. That remains the case, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have, you know, I'm from South Carolina, and so we have Lindsey Graham, who, you know, is constantly in the news taking on kind of what's going on in Washington. And so I think that's still, you know, you're not going to tell us what to do down in this region is still a big driver.
What is it about this region that seems to be the modus operandi, for lack of a better term?
I mean, I think a lot of it does go back to the Civil War, and it goes back to the Civil Rights Movement, right? I mean, I think if you're trying to understand why Southerners think the things that they think about government, certainly some of it comes there, right? I mean, this sort of battle that I think historians have settled, but folks still seem to be debating about in the popular press about states' rights versus slavery. I mean, these are really battles over who has power.
States' rights versus anything.
Right, exactly. I mean, these are really battles over politics in the most real sense. Who has power to govern. And I think there's a different view of that power, at least historically in the South. As we argue, we think that's changed a little bit over time, but I think that's kind of how we got to where we are today.
Maybe this is the wrong question to ask of a political scientist. Maybe I should ask it of sociologists, but you dated it back to slavery. But yeah. Does it go back further than that? Is it all about – is it because of slavery, because the South was told you can't do this anymore, that they have this sticking our heels in the sand kind of mentality when it comes to being told what to do by other parts of the country? Or is it something else? Is it something that came across the ocean with us from settlers from England?
Yeah, it's probably a lot of these, right? Like a lot of things, we try to figure out what is the cause. It's probably not monocausal, right? There's probably not one cause. At the same time, there's some political scientists up at Harvard who've just written sort of some great work connecting places with the largest slave populations to places with some of the most racially exclusionary public opinion today. So what does that mean? What that means is we're still seeing the sort of relevance of slavery to American political life in the South even today.
Well, we have other. I'm reading an article right now from an old New York Times. I stack up the New York Times Sunday magazines, and I read them when I get to them. So I have no idea when this was written, probably a year and a half ago. But I'm reading this article about the segregation of the New York City public schools. The North and the city of New York still have terribly segregated public schools. They were worse than the South. Mm-hmm. In the 1960s, mm-hmm. far worse than the South.
Right, and there's still segregated schools, you know, yes. All over the country.
So is that same attitude must permeate the country. It's not just a Southern thing.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think there's still, you know, this is a country where that continues to struggle with race and continues to struggle with that issue. But again, as Chris said, what we found in our book was there were a lot of things about Southern identity here in, you know, the post 2010, the last decade or so, that really unites both African Americans living in the South and whites living in the South. There's still some differences, but there's this sort of connection around family and food and tradition and the rural landscape that we were a little bit surprised to see. I mean, when we were growing up in the 80s and 90s, you think of a Southerner, you think of a white guy hanging out in a rural area. And I think that's a mistake here in 2017. I think there's a lot. Being a Southerner is a more inclusive term than it really ever has been in the past.
Well, in your research, you found that the vast majority of people living here, three quarters of them, readily identify as being Southern. So now how many of these people are native-born people? How many of them came from elsewhere? Because three quarters sounds like a lot on the one hand, but maybe not so.
Yeah, I think it does sound like a lot, and I think it is a lot, right? So we would expect this, and a lot of folks have argued we'd expect this to decline, right? So the idea of sort of homogenization of everything, right? So you could be listening to this show, hopefully you're listening to it in Charlotte, but you could be listening to it in Bangladesh right now, right? You can listen to it on the internet. The landscape looks more and more similar, right? Drive to work most days in Cullowhee, North Carolina, and there's a road in Cullowhee that's going to look a lot like a road in Wisconsin. So because of all that, I think a lot of people thought, hey, Southern identity is going to go away. Why would you connect to a region when the world looks more and more the same? And what we found is the opposite, that about three quarters of people still connect. That number has stayed fairly constant, at least since we have good data from. So what does that mean? For us, that means that people find a reason to connect still, right? So despite this landscape that looks the same, people still want to connect to something personal and something real and something about region. Some folks sort of assimilate into the South, and so those are the folks who move here. Some of those have been here their whole lives.
You have, I guess it's for fun, but in the book, you break down various states and regions into how Southern they really are. You rank states by the percentage of people who identify as being Southern. It's no surprise that Mississippi tops the list. You call them Southern to the core.
That's right. Very scientific term.
Yeah. You place Virginia in with Oklahoma. I never knew Oklahoma was Southern.
That's a matter of some debate.
That's a good
debate.
Question. So typically, most researchers look at the 11 states of the old Confederacy,
right,
and that
right.
doesn't include Oklahoma and Kentucky. We decided to include Oklahoma and Kentucky because enough people look at them as having some degree of Southernness. But again, they typically are lower down on the list. Florida and Texas are less Southern than places. Really, the core of the South, the Deep South, for as five states: Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, and South Carolina.
So you've got Oklahoma and Virginia as sorta Southern. That's your academic terminology there. And you place North and South Carolina in the category of pretty darn Southern,
along with
Georgia. But you didn't mention North Carolina just a second ago when you put South Carolina and Georgia together. Why?
Well, North Carolina is typically considered to be part of the peripheral South or the Rim South, not that core kind of heart of Dixie, deep South. But, you know, North Carolina and South Carolina have a lot in common. And North Carolina, you know, politically had always been thought of as being a little more progressive. Yeah. And that's really changed, as people in North Carolina know, over the last 5, 6, 7 years. And, you know, North Carolina is looking a lot more like South Carolina every day in terms of its politics. I lived in North Carolina for 12 years. I worked with Chris at Western Carolina University, and I thought I was moving to a more conservative place. And since I've moved in 2012, sometimes, you know, South Carolina is a little bit to the left of North Carolina on some policy.
Well, Charleston would be.
Charleston, right? Especially, yeah. Yes.
But is that because you would think the opposite would be true, because we have so many newcomers to North Carolina from other parts of the country, mostly from the North and maybe some from the Midwest, West Virginia, places like that. Mm-hmm. But so many newcomers, why are we becoming more conservative, more Southern? What's happening here?
Well, I'm not sure that I would completely conflate those two things, right? So being conservative and being Southern aren't necessarily the same thing. For example, we find that African Americans today are at least as likely as whites in the South to identify as Southern. African Americans are also the core of the Democratic Party in the South, right? So I think when we completely conflate political ideology, whether you're liberal or conservative, and Southern identity, whether you're Southern or not, we may be speaking more of a white experience than a Southern experience.
Well, then why are we becoming more conservative? Take that out of it.
Sure,
If people are coming from other parts of the country, particularly the North, right, where they are thought to be less conservative, why are we becoming more? Is it the backlash? What is it?
Yeah, I mean, So I'm not convinced that I think the policies coming out of our General Assembly are absolutely becoming more conservative. At the same time, there's still more registered Democrats and Republicans in the state. At the same time, it is still a swing state going forward. At the same time, we still just now, grant you, barely, but we did just elect a Democratic governor. We elected, obviously, a state Supreme Court justice who was, although not ID'd on the ballot, was an African-American Democrat. So I'm not sure that the people of North Carolina have flipped as quickly as the policies of North Carolina have flipped.
Wow. You may not know the answer to this either, and that's okay. But are there other regions of the country in which people seem eager to identify? Because in reading through your book, people are eager. If they identify as Southern, they are eager to say that.
Yeah, we didn't go into that, so we don't know for sure. I mean, certainly folks in New England seem to, that's one of the areas they seem to sort of connect the most, whether it's around, especially in the Boston area and the Patriots and sort of that regional identity. But, you know, we don't know for sure. I think that's sort of a future research project to see if the connection to the South that strong connection is similar in other parts of the country. I do think, though, that people have overlapping identities. And so even within the South, we have people that might connect with kind of the mountain region, or they might connect with Cajun culture. And so, again, trying to figure out how some of those overlapping identities play out is a topic that we want to look at in the future.
Is the eagerness to identify, is it based on pride? Is it based on comfort? Is it based on just, this is where I live, this is where I grew up, and I love it here? And we have 20 seconds.
A little bit of all of those things in 20 seconds. No, I think for most folks, it's complicated, right? It's not one thing. I think it's a lot of different things, but it's a connection to roots, broadly defined.
It's Dr. Christopher Cooper. He's here with Dr. Gibbs Knotts, and together they have written The Resilience of Southern Identity, Why the South Still Matters in the Minds of Its People. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Shiel Sexton, a commercial construction partner committed to delivering outcomes through experience, supervision, and accountable management, whose mission is integrity, expertise, and relationships. Details at shielsexton.com. And WTVI-PBS Charlotte's Carolina Impact, this week highlighting Ann Springs Close Greenway in Fort Mill and its commitment to land preservation, plus a preview of the annual Bloomy Awards Carolina Impact tonight at 8 on PBS Charlotte. George Saunders is the man Time magazine calls the best short story writer in English. Not one of, but the best. And this short story wizard has just released his first novel, Lincoln in the Bardo, about President Lincoln's son, Willie, who died in the White House at the age of 11. Saunders is in Charlotte for CPCC's Sensoria Festival. He will spend the hour with us talking about writing, his switch to writing novels, and his appearances on Stephen Colbert tomorrow at 9.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the Next On Point, looking to buy a home? Welcome to the toughest market in a decade. We'll look at the map of real estate realities around the country. That's coming up on the Next On Point from NPR.
On Point, coming up from 10 to noon, after Charlotte Talks, on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHA. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the resilience of Southern identity. That's the book by our guest today, Dr. Christopher Cooper and Dr. Gibbs Knotts. Dr. Cooper's with Western Carolina University. Dr. Knotts is with the College of Charleston. Off the air just a second ago, the two of you said something really interesting that we weren't going to talk about because it never occurred to me. But you said, Dr. Knotts, that people become defensive about the South, not just white people, African-American people, when right, they perceive absolutely. A slight or a mischaracterization in the press.
Yeah, so one of the things we did in this book was we had four focus groups, two with white folks and two with African-Americans, and we asked them, and they were all Southerners, and we asked them kind of different questions, and we were really struck by how defensive people would get when they saw the South being talked about in a negative way by a reporter or in the national press or on the by Jon Stewart on Comedy Central. And so basically they were very, very defensive and said, you know, look, this isn't fair. This isn't really what this region is about. Sure, there's some people here who aren't necessarily representing the region in a good way, but that's a small minority, and it's not really fair that the national media picks on us like they do. And we were struck, thought that was really interesting.
You know, I don't recall seeing other regions of the country, maybe Valley Girls in California, picked on the way we are. And when we're picked on, we're usually picked on by somebody dressing up in a torn T-shirt and talking like this.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So what is it about us that makes us pick-onable?
Yeah, so, you know, the South has always been looked at, fairly or unfairly, as different, right? And so I think you made a really good point about sort of discrimination and segregation in the North. But the reality is, for most folks, they think it's worse in the South, whether it really is, right? So political scientists, for years, they run these fancy statistical models, and the South was so different, they would stick in a term just for figuring out if somebody was Southern or not. Like, we think we know this about voting behavior, but the South is so darn weird that we have to control for this in a totally different way. And so I think there's always been a sense of sort of Southern otherness, that Southerners are different.
Well, are they? Because off the year you said that a lot of people who out-migrate, who leave the South, suddenly realize – I think the analogy you use was a fish out of water.
Right.
They don't know they're in water until they're out of it.
Yeah, that's right. So many of the folks we talked to told a very similar story, right? One about living in the South, not really thinking a lot about it, not a lot of introspection, and then moving out of the region or visiting out of the region, and all of a sudden folks act like they're different, and it makes them defensive, and it makes them realize that the South is still different. And I think Gibbs and I find that even if the landscape looks more similar, the people are still distinct in some ways that matter.
What is that difference?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's definitely political differences. There's a different racial makeup in the South than there are other parts of the country. Certainly the history is different. But, you know, I think the first things people said in our focus groups when we said, you know, what does being Southern mean to you, or what is important about being Southern? And they would talk about family and the food and the landscape. I mean, it's those folk ways.
But we all have family. We all eat food. We all live in the world.
But a unique – it's a really good point – but a unique type of Southern food, and we're sort of seeing a resurgence of that. Certainly where I live in Charleston, I mean, it is booming with all these they're doing grits in all kind of different ways these days.
And so, well, and we actually have a little bit of survey data where we ask people, you know, just what do you like to eat? And what we find is that Black Southerners and white Southerners have sort of more common palates than whites do in the South versus whites in, say, Wisconsin. And that, if
what,
first,
what does that mean?
Well, I think what that means is actually something pretty important. What it means is that food and these folkways are ways that folks connect across racial lines, and I think help identify them as uniquely Southern, right? And so it may not seem high-minded, and Gibbs and I have had this conversation before. I think we both expected people to talk about politics and the big ideas that make you Southern. What people told us instead was the common daily occurrences of life are different here, and that's how folks connect. And I think that actually ends up structuring all sorts of different ways about how you think about the world.
Given the influx of all the newcomers coming in from other parts of the world and other parts of the country, because we are the fastest growing area of the country and we're the most populous area of the country, how have we been able to maintain Southernness?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think partly there's a little bit of a selection effect on who moves here. So, you know, I think that people might be a little more open to the culture here if they make the decision to move from Chicago or New York. But I think it's a lot of these traditions are pretty strongly ingrained. And I also think that it has been – it's a – being sort of regional identity has been a more – has been more open to African Americans and other racial groups connecting, and I think that's kept the percentage of identifiers at this high level.
But areas like where you grew up, Atlanta, here in Charlotte, Nashville, Birmingham, these are areas that are becoming increasingly not only urbanized but metropolitanized.
Right. They're suburbanized, yeah.
But I mean, I just mean that they're a mesh of different cultures,
right,
as well as being tightly knit and close in, like with all these apartment buildings going up here in Charlotte. That's not only it's a product of in-migration to a degree because people have to have a place to live, but a lot of those people want to live in that environment. They don't want to live out with the great big yard in the middle of nowhere and drive an hour to work. Is that reducing our Southernness in some way as we become more like a northern city?
I think it's changing what it means to be Southern, but no, I don't actually think, and I don't think we think, that it is actually reducing Southernness, right? So just look, the book is titled The Resilience of Southern Identity. You know the takeaway point, but at the same time, that doesn't mean that we think it's the same as it ever was. It's certainly not. It's changing over time. What it means to be Southern is changing. So it's just one small indication. We have this chapter in the book where we look at business names, right? Do you call your business Dixie Bicycle Shop? Do you call it Southern Bicycle Shop, or do you call it something else? And what we find is that Dixie, as a measure of Southernness, kind of the Old South, if you will, has been declining pretty rapidly, really, over time, whereas Southern has been staying fairly constant. And I think that tells us that Southern...
They mean the same thing?
I think they don't mean the same thing. So we actually did a little bit of work to try to figure out what are the nature of these businesses even. What we find, not surprisingly, is that they're different types of businesses in different types of places.
Is tacking the name Southern onto your business something that is particular to the South? I know I've seen Northern in the North, but does it happen in the Midwest, the Pacific Northwest, the desert Southwest? Does it happen there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think certainly part of that is just a connection to the region.
Okay.
But there is, you know, there's this degree of Southern pride that exists out there that, you know, makes this region maybe a little bit different.
And then, of course, there's Texas.
That's it. Texas is its own place.
Yeah, we're getting a little pushback here from people on email.
Good.
And Twitter. Tiffany on Twitter, I've been here for 7 years, but I do not identify as Southern. My husband would agree. He was born and raised here. I'm from up north. We had many a laugh at our cultural differences. Denise on Facebook, I moved to Charlotte 6 years ago from New Jersey. I will always be a Jersey girl, no matter how old I am or how long I live here. Have lots of friends who have lived here all their lives. They call me their token Yankee. That's not all they call her, right? But that's another term for that. You begin your book by talking about four people, Paula Deen, James Clyburn, Natasha Trethewey, is that how you say her name?
Yes.
And Patterson Hood. Deen, of course, is the famous TV cook down in Savannah. Clyburn is the minister and a member of the U.S. House. Trethewey is a poet. Patterson's the lead singer of the rock band Drive-By Truckers. And then in chapter one, the first person you talk about is Dylan Roof.
Right.
The Charleston shooter in the Charleston church massacre. Five very different people, five very different Southerners. So the basic question, They're so different. Yeah. What does it mean to be Southern?
So that's a great question. So we wanted to – part of the reason we picked those four at the beginning was to have somebody who was a little older, somebody who was a little younger. We wanted males and females and African-Americans and white folks. And all four of those individuals at the beginning do – being Southern is a very important part of their identity. And we really use that as a springboard to say, okay, well, are they pretty typical, or how many people out there are like them? How strong is Southern identity? The Dylann Roof thing is interesting because we wanted to make sure very early in the book we said, look, there is a dark side to Southern identity. Make no mistake. We are not saying that Southern identity is all a good thing. There's a lot of negative stuff that's happened, and we picked Dylann Roof as maybe the ultimate example of that. He one of his friends, I think, said he was motivated in part by some kind of perverse identity with the South. And so I do think it's important to remind the readers that Southern identity has some negative and historically negative consequences.
And prior to the unpleasantness which leaked out from the dark side with Paula Deen,
right.
She was universally popular. I mean, people who would never eat butter fried anything,
that's right,
would watch her with fascination.
That's right.
Why? You know, she is prototypically Southern.
She is in a lot of ways.
And bright, sunny, friendly, and very Southern.
Right. And it turns out more than a bit racist in this case, right? So, but yes, I think for a while that was sort of the view. And I think, she was a character. And she was a character that we see a lot of examples of throughout the sort of popular history, right? I mean, if you look at the Andy Griffith Show, right? I mean, it's the same kind of character that people are playing off of. And in some ways, that's also what our focus group participants were responding to in somewhat of a negative way, right? I think people actually mentioned hee-haw as being this view of the South that they do not identify with. So I think she was playing a character, played it very, very well. And I think one point we're trying to make with these four folks, too, in more direct answer to your question, is there's not one way that people think of what it means to be Southern, mm-hmm. right? There are Southern cultures. There's not necessarily Southern culture.
But they were also fascinated, the viewers, I think, with not only with Paula Deen, and she was a very likable figure at that time, but they were fascinated with what she was cooking, because Southern food outside of the South, for some reason, apparently,
right.
is exotic.
Yes.
Right. Why?
Right. I think it, you know, so much of it was, you know, people in the South, you know, were able to prepare what they had growing outside or what they had walking around outside. And so this whole farm-to-table movement and fresh food movement, I think, that's taken off really across the country is big in the South. And I think you're right. I think it's exotic and different. And there's been some really unbelievable chefs that have, you know, whether it's Sean Brock in Charleston, who've really put it on the national map.
How would you describe it? I mean, Southern food is not a monolith.
Absolutely.
It's not just deep fried steak. I mean, chicken fried steak.
No.
What is it? How would you describe it?
Typically bad for you? No, I don't know. I mean, I think Gibbs is right. I think it comes from things that tended to be a little bit cheaper, things that folks could grow, things that didn't cost a lot of money, right? It was a way to get a lot of flavor out of not a lot of money.
Yeah.
And I think that has you know, sort of changed Southern cuisine. I also think Southern cuisine in a lot of ways is, you know, sort of heterogeneous or diverse, right? You've got an entire way of cooking that is not based on white people. And it's not just based on African Americans, right? It's a place where people come together. And I think maybe that makes it different than, say, eating kielbasa when you go to Wisconsin.
I don't know that this is in the book, but I do know it's in an article that you wrote. You point out that there are large differences between the frequency with which Southerners and non-Southerners eat the most stereotypical Southern foods. Southerners are nearly four times more likely than non-Southerners to eat okra and chitlins frequently, about three times more likely to eat boiled peanuts and moon pies, nearly twice as likely to eat catfish, and more likely to have eaten sweet potato pie and fried tomatoes. You wrote those
That's
words,
right.
didn't
yes.
you? A lot of Northerners don't know what chitlins are and don't want to. And my first exposure to boiled peanuts was when I lived in Columbia, and I went to Cromer's,
yes,
where
right.
you can buy the worst peanuts in the world. That's a sign
yep.
on the store, and it was boiled peanuts. I must tell you, Yeah. They are disgusting.
Yeah, a lot of people say that. And I grew up eating. I mean, you know, when I'd go to an aunt or uncle's house, that's the first thing they'd have, boiled peanuts. And not a lot of these fancy restaurants in Charleston, that's sort of the app. Instead of bringing out bread, they bring out boiled peanuts for people at the table to share. But it's definitely an acquired taste.
But Southern food is one of our delineators. It is one of the things that sets us apart in the minds of others.
I think it's right. And I think, again, it's these folkways. It's you know, it is a little bit still the accent, although we find some evidence maybe that's fading a little bit. It's food. It's speech patterns. It's the way folks think about family and genealogy even, right? I mean, it's
perception of hospitality. I mean, you know, again, you know, the point of our book, too, is not to necessarily say people in the South are nicer. That is not the objective. But what we can say pretty convincingly is that people in the South think they are more hospitable. They think that this idea of Southern hospitality exists. You know, whether it does or not, that's probably for a future set of researchers to do, but there's certainly that perception out there.
You say, and I thought this was interesting, you say that conservatives are more likely to identify as Southern than are moderates and liberals, and you say that's a key finding, one that's happening even as Southern identity is becoming more geographically inclusive. Talk about that.
So basically, the University of North Carolina did some Southern focus polls in the 1990s, and that was a really important baseline for our study, and we crunched those numbers like crazy. And then we did our own poll in 2012. Mm-hmm. And basically, back in the 1990s, your ideology, your whether you were conservative or liberal, didn't have an effect when we crunched the numbers and put that in a statistical model to determine whether you were Southern or not. But that was something that in our most recent survey, it was an important predictor of being Southern. And so that was a key finding. And then the other was that racial makeup, whites were more likely to say they were Southern in the 1990s. And when we looked at it today in the current survey, race was not related to being Southern. And so it was no longer about being white or black. It was some other factors that impacted being Southern.
But you also point out that a lot of the 75% of the people living here who identify as Southern are African American. You say it actually surprised you that they are even more likely to identify as Southerners as whites.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about like the Dixiecrat movement, when Strom Thurmond ran for president, you think about George Wallace, you know, a crowd of whites, you know, listening to Dixie, waving the Confederate flag, fighting against the federal government, you know, what it meant to be Southern in the 1960s. I think a lot of folks have an image in their head. What we wanted to do was challenge that image a little bit and say, look, you know, it's a more diverse place, and there are some things that bring Southerners together across different racial groups.
So all that stuff is fading into the background, all the things that you mentioned and things you didn't mention, like slavery and the Civil War, and
the Confederate flag
and
right.
Jim Crow, that's all fading into the background for African-Americans who identify as Southern? They're just Southern because they're Southern?
I wouldn't say it's fading in the background, right? So when we were talking to people in these focus groups, it isn't that they were thinking that it was going away, right? We actually have some pretty moving stories from African-Americans in the South about daily interaction with the Confederate flag and how it made folks feel. So it's not that we think they're fading. It's there. Again, like Gibbs said, there is this dark side of Southern identity that we would like to go away, but it probably never will go away completely.
Dr. Christopher Cooper, along with Dr. Gibbs Knotts, who have written this book, The Resilience of Southern Identity, Why the South Still Matters in the Minds of Its People. We'll continue to investigate what they've come up with through their focus groups. And we'll talk about how you did the research, because that might be interesting. When we come back, Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the North Carolina Transportation Museum, hosting steam train excursions this spring. Half-day round trips from Spencer to Charlotte and Spencer to Greensboro Sunday. Seating options at nctrans.org. And Heartwood Tree Service. Emerald ash borer is in the Carolinas and will severely impact Charlotte's tree canopy. Ash tree owners can take steps to protect and keep their trees healthy. Details at heartwoodtree.com. Looking to buy a home? Well, welcome to the toughest market in a decade in many parts of the U.S., including ours. So, on point today with guest host Jane Clayson, we'll look at the map of real estate realities around the country. If you'd like to join our conversation about what it means to be Southern, now's your shot. Join our conversation at charlottetalks at WFAE.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
I have a name for my Prius that I have now. I call her Serena. I'm Sam Sanders, reporter with NPR. When I started college, I drove my father's old pickup truck. It was a 2000 Dodge Dakota. I loved that truck. I had friends that would call it shaky when the shocks got bad. Imagine that truck, the low shaky, becoming my favorite program.
Thanks for donating your unwanted vehicle. Visit WFAE.org/cars for details.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Dr. Gibbs Knotts from the College of Charleston and Dr. Christopher Cooper from Western Carolina University, both political science professors. Together, they have written, after a considerable amount of research, The Resilience of Southern Identity, Why the South Still Matters in the Minds of the People. Let me share some more emails here. Peggy emails, one very Southern thing is calling grown women miss, and then the first name. Drives me crazy, she said. I think that's cute. Donald on Twitter, being from New Mexico, I totally relate to the idea of Southerness. Never really became Southern, though. Greg writes, a big debate in the South in the past year has concerned transgender rights and bathrooms, particularly in North Carolina and Virginia. This morning, in light of the General Assembly's partial repeal of HB 2, the NCAA announced that North Carolina can again host championship games. So how is the South changing politically?
The South has changed, it has changed and is changing politically very rapidly over time, right? So we went from being an overwhelmingly solidly Democratic South to a two-party South. And then the question is, I think, are we a one-party Republican South or are we still a two-party
South? But didn't the parties change identity and philosophy? Isn't that why the South switched its allegiance? Because the Democrats forced integration and they abandoned them.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. Certainly, yes, the parties have changed and Southern partisanship has changed. I think both of those things have happened at the same sort of time. I think it's hard to figure out sometimes which one actually came first. And there's some pretty good arguments that some political scientists make that, yes, it was the sudden influx of African-American voters into the Democratic Party that then the whites that were left in the Democratic Party wanted to control something, so they went to the Republican Party, and that sort of led to this shift. So this all kind of happened at the same time. As far as the transgender rights piece, I think the fact that this is a debate about transgender rights in the South shows in some ways how much the South has changed. I mean, 20 years ago, if you had said that North Carolinians would in the end come out the majority against something like HB2, I think I would have certainly been surprised 20 years ago.
Absolutely. But there is this dark side that you've talked about, and there's another dark side distinct from the old Confederacy in the old South. You write that this collective Southern identity includes the fact that as a region, the South remains demographically distinct, with lower percentages of high school graduates, lower housing values, not in Charlotte, lower household incomes, and a higher percentage of people in poverty. Not exactly the stuff of bragging rights.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, I think, and within the South, certain Southern states always say, well, at least we're not Alabama, or at least we're not Mississippi. And so I think, I think that's going to change over time. I think that this is still a region where the economy is growing. The Southern states are doing a lot to go out and recruit businesses. And so I do think it's an area that will eventually change and there will be more demographic parity between the South and other parts of the country.
Hmm. How did you conduct your research?
That's a great question. So we're political scientists. We're social scientists. And so we like to make evidence-based arguments. And so we have three chapters that basically are our empirical chapters. One, we look at these business names. And so we go out and try to analyze all kind of different ways, these different the presence of Dixie and Southern business names and the types of businesses and the types of locations that have these names as a measure of identity. The next chapter, our next empirical chapter, looks at a ton of surveys. We look at all kind of different surveys, including one that we conducted on our own to try to understand who connects with the South, but also questions like, the South is the best region to live in, who thinks that it is, who thinks that it isn't, and why. And then the final and maybe the most important chapter, one of our best decisions when writing this book, was to sit down and talk with people who consider themselves to be Southerners. And we did that in these focus groups. And the reason we had focus groups with African Americans and focus groups with whites is we wanted to be able to go in and ask questions about the Confederate flag or the Civil War. And because of the importance of race in the South, we wanted people to feel comfortable talking about kind of how they've been discriminated against and have it have that be kind of the way we...
How many of those focus groups did you have?
A total of four. So we had two with whites and two with African Americans. We're not at liberty to say where. Actually,
what part of the state?
It was in the South. It was in a medium sized southern city. We've got these university human subjects boards that will actually come in and smack us in the middle of the studio if we tell you where.
Professionally conducted, or did you guys conduct them?
We'd like to think we're professionals, but yes, professionally conducted by us.
What I mean is that there are people who make it their livelihood
to
know how to frame questions and conduct focus groups to get the least biased answers.
We work with a policy center at a university to help pull the people in, but we actually went in and did them.
Did you also have them... Focus groups consist of a moderator who asks questions and elicits answers, but sometimes they also do it in writing. They have the oral part, but they also have the written part. Did you do the written part?
No, we just did.
The oral part is a leader emerges in a group of strangers and becomes the influencer of other people, and so it taints the information.
Yeah, that's a great point. And, you know, we did not do that. You know, that's, even when as a teacher, you know, sometimes it's really good to get students to write down their comments because we've all been in classrooms where there's a certain student who doesn't want to share, and if you get them to write it down, you're like, oh. That person has a lot of great ideas. I wish they'd raise their hand more often.
So all of these were conducted in the same area?
They were conducted in the same area.
Did you find – I guess you asked the same questions or fairly much the same questions of every group. Did you find a wide variety of differences in your answers from group to group?
It really – this is what – one of the things we found really interesting is that it depended on what part of Southern identity we're talking about. So if you ask people, what does it mean to be Southern, sort of the question that I think you actually let out with today, we saw remarkable consistency, right? And that tended to be about these what we're calling folkways, right? The hospitality, the food, all the things we've been talking about today. Where the group started to diverge was when we talked, not surprising, about matters of race, the Confederate flag, and the Civil War. And that's where we started to see the kind of opinions about what it means to be Southern and the importance of those symbols change by group.
Yeah, and white respondents, they tended to say, okay, well, you know, the Civil War happened, but we're ready to move on. For African Americans, it was, much more serious issue, much more looking backwards, and much more, saying a lot more about the importance that that had in their day-to-day life.
And yet, you point out, and this happens with discussions about race, too, I'm not a racist, therefore let's move on.
Right.
And that's not something that some people can do in the African-American community because they live it
every
day.
I think that's exactly right. We have this great – I'm sorry.
So I'm just going to – how do we come together? How do we have the other side see the other side's opinion and understand it?
Well, you know, I think part of it is to understand that Southern identity may be resilient. There are things that folks can come around to talk about the same issues, right, and to identify in the same ways. And then there's also this part of Southern identity that is going to be distinct, right? I mean, I think it's all the old saws about understanding and appreciating difference sometimes, right? We don't all have to think the same way about really any issue, but in particular the South, and in our case, for us to move forward as a region.
For a long time, the South – this is pre-Civil War and even into the 20th century, the South was fairly rural and fairly isolated, and it wasn't industrial, and we kept to ourselves and we kept to our own ways. And I think that helped lead to an emergence in the South through literature. I mean, people like William Faulkner and Tennessee Williams and others, Southern writers wrote these Southern tales that people around the country, around the world, were fascinated with because we were so peculiar, we were so different. Could a William Faulkner, a Tennessee Williams, emerge today, or have we become less different?
I think they have, and I think they are, right? I mean, they may not be as prominent because there's so much media we can get. But, you know, I think about sort of a selfish example, but Ron Rash over at Western Carolina University, I think, is a great example of somebody who's
– He's been on this program.
He's great, right? And his he has a good selection of what shows to go on. But, you know, I think his fiction and his short stories and his poetry is uniquely Southern and uniquely Appalachian. I think to this point Gibbs made before about overlapping identities. So absolutely, I think we still see these folks, even in the popular realm. I mean, John Grisham's books are Southern books. Like if that guy's living in Wisconsin, he's writing a different book than when he is living in Mississippi and in Charlottesville, Virginia.
William on Facebook, as someone born and raised in North Carolina, I've noticed that people or companies that use the phrase Dixie in advertising are not from the South.
That's interesting. Yeah, you know, I guess, Charlotte, the big department store, Belk, they have a whole sort of Southern angle that they have with a lot of their advertising. But, you know, one of the things we found was that Dixie businesses tended to be more restaurants but not – people weren't investing their money in Dixie insurance or Dixie financial planning or anything like
that. What about Winn-Dixie?
No, that's really interesting that you say that. So Winn-Dixie is out of Florida, I believe, and the previous research who'd worked on this decided to take Winn-Dixie out of the analysis. And so we followed that lead because it made Florida look like the most Southern place in the country, and we all know that's not true. And so because Winn-Dixie got so big and had so many stores, we set Winn-Dixie aside. But it's a great point because it is probably the most prominent Dixie business out there.
For those who don't know, that's a grocery store.
That's a grocery store.
Michael emails in his book, The Mind of the South, W.G. Cash, who you refer to many times in your book, focused on the power of fear and how it served to create the mind of Southerners. How does his scholarship fit into your research? And isn't that still going on today, not just in the South, but around the country?
Yeah, no, absolutely right. So I'm impressed with the question, and I think you're right. I think Cash talked about a lot of things that matter for our book, and obviously the role of fear is one of them. And I think this plays right into one of the things we've been talking about today, the sort of Southern otherness, right? How folks feel threatened, even if not physically threatened, but threatened by culture taking over a Southern culture, for example. I mean, that's a type of threat. And I think that's one of the types of things that Cash was talking about and that we talk about. So yeah, if somebody said, give me five things to read about the South that are really going to help me understand the region, Cash would still be in my top five.
You know, something happened in the, I guess, 1960s, 70s, 80s around the country. It's not just here. Maybe it was the interstate highway system that happened that did all this. But suddenly, everything began to become the same. You can go to a shopping mall. All the malls in the country look the same. They have the same four stores as anchors. They have the same shoe stores, the Limited, the same, you know, dress shops. The Limited's out of business now. You have the same fast food restaurants in every town in America. As you mentioned, the highways look the same. There's a federal standard for highways. So how have we been able to maintain Southernness, distinctiveness, when everything is the same? And we have the same movies, the same television shows, the same music, the same everything. How has it been possible to maintain this?
We think that it's opened up and become a more inclusive term, and that African Americans are now more than ever willing to call themselves Southerners. I think that's an important part of the story. Anything? What else do you think, Chris?
I think it's sort of counterintuitive, but because the landscape looks the same, I think that's why Southernness has held on. Right. When people see the world looking more and more alike, you want a way to connect to your region. You want a way to connect to place. And I think regional identity, Southern identity in our case, is a really good example of how.
You bring up a guy named Peter Applebaum. Is that how you say his name?
Yeah.
He's the author of a book called Dixie Rising and several other books. And he says that it isn't that Southern characteristics in the South are slipping away as much as it is the rest of the country becoming more Southern. What does that mean?
You know, I think he's talking about things like NASCAR, right? It's sort of these stereotypically Southern ideas, or I got to go to New York in a few weeks for a wedding, and I guarantee I'm going to see a dozen Southern-type restaurants. I'm going to see people selling Southern goods in New York. I think what he's saying is this culture has spread throughout the country more so than the country has come down to the South. Not everybody agrees with Peter Applebaum, but I think it's an argument that you've got to take seriously.
Yeah, and I think politically as the country, you know, as Republicans have taken over the House, Senate, and now the presidency, and the country has become a little more conservative, you know, there's the political dimension to that as well, because this has always been a conservative part of the country vis-a-vis the rest of the country.
Sharon emails, I'm an African-American woman. My parents from Charleston. I was raised in New Jersey. It was not a culture shock when my husband and I moved to South Carolina 22 years ago. I noticed quickly two things. Southern food up north is referred to as soul food in the north, but down here it's simply Southern cuisine. And I noticed that names are traditionally considered black names up north, like Sadie and Ernestine, etc. They're commonly held by white people down here.
It seems like it's a fascinating story. I think that I don't have the data, but I assume you're right. I mean, I think that's I think it tells us something. Things like naming and food, these sort of common occurrences of life, I think, as the person who wrote in is listening said, are key to understanding what it means to be Southern.
You have concluded, obviously, by the title of your book, that Southern identity is resilient, but you're also convinced that the ways people connect with the region today are different than they were in the past. How so, and over time, will this make us less resilient or more so?
Yeah, I think again, it's less about the political. It's less about taking a stand politically against the rest of the country, and more about a celebration of folkways and food that really make the region the regional connections that we have today.
And what is the I'm going to have to say this very slowly. The deconfederatization of the country. Of the region doing to the South and Southern identity.
Yeah, so that's a term a guy named Derek Alderman, who's at the University of Tennessee, came up with. And so the argument there is, look, if you're seeing the Confederate names, the Confederate monuments, the Confederate schools changing their names over time, that is a sign of deconfederatization. I think what that tells us is, again, the South is changing.
Dr. Christopher Cooper from Western Carolina University, Dr. Gibbs Knotts from the College of Charleston. Together they have written The Resilience of Southern Identity, Why the South Still Matters in the Minds of Its People. Thanks for the hour.
Thanks.
Thank you.